Welcome to the North Peninsula Review, Portland City Council District 2 Candidates Forum. My name's Seamus Linsky. I'll be the moderator tonight. I live here in St. John's. I've lived here for about 20 years, been involved in various things, and I was asked to moderate tonight. So thank you all for coming. I just want to make a couple quick announcements. First of all, I'd like to thank our hosts, St. John's Church and pastors Josh Hawk and Dave Libby. Hey, Dave and Josh, can you stand and wave? Thanks, guys. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Cathedral Park Neighborhood Association. So thanks for co-sponsoring this. And the staff of the North Peninsula Review for organizing and sponsoring this event. So. And the North Peninsula Review is publishers and editors Barbara Quinn and Mark Kirschmeyer. Stand and wave. There you go. And contributor Ruth Lane. Where's Ruth? Is she? She might be back there. So. And of course, I'd like to thank all of the candidates for coming here tonight. So let's have a round of applause for everyone. Okay, so this is a moderated forum. Before we start, will everyone do me a favor and take out your phones and turn them off? Or put them on airplane mode, but definitely silence them. Thanks. All right, so tonight we're gonna have four rounds of questions. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to answer each question. The first two questions are questions that the North Peninsula Review and I chose. And then the second two or three, depending on the time, questions will be from you, the audience. So here's how that's gonna work. As you came in, you should have, if you wanted, you could have picked up a index card and there were pencils back there. So if you have a question for the candidates, in the first half an hour of this evening, if you wouldn't mind writing that down as legibly as you can, at about the 30-minute mark, volunteers will come around and collect your questions. And then the editorial staff of the North Peninsula Review will select two or three questions from the audience, and then I will read your questions to the candidates for the last two rounds. So it'll be two editorial questions, two audience questions. Each candidate will have about 2 minutes to answer those. And we should get you out of here around 8:30. Let me check my notes, make sure I said everything. That's about it. When we're done, as we're kind of cleaning up in here, many of the candidates might stick around in the foyer back there to have sort of an informal meet and greet. Also back there, there's campaign literature, and Donna Cohen's back there with information about emergency preparedness and transportation infrastructure. So make sure and visit those tables. And lastly, and very importantly, we'll do our best to give you the results of the Roosevelt High School boys basketball semifinal game against PIL rivals Grant High School, which is happening right now over at Portland University, or University of Portland. Okay, that's it. So candidates, let's start our first round. You'll each have a chance to answer this question, and you'll have 2 minutes to do so. But for this first question, we're gonna give you an extra 15 seconds, so generous, to just introduce yourself, say your name and the neighborhood you're from, and then you'll answer the question. Sound good? All right. The first question is a two-parter. It's city policy that the Police Bureau's North Precinct should have about 120 officers. Currently, North Precinct has about 89 officers. And for context, the other precincts have around 100 police officers. So the two-part question is, do you favor increasing North Precinct staffing? And then the second part is, if yes, where would you get the funding to do that? And if not, how would you address the public safety issues facing residents here in North Portland? Oh, wait. You get your own microphone.
Do I need to stand? Do you want me to sit?
Whichever you prefer.
Okay. Well, hello, everyone. My name is John Middleton. I'm from the Concordia neighborhood. Kind of interesting you start with this question. North and Northeast Portland has always been kind of been the dumping ground, and they're where they hide everything. Never been equitably serviced. Do I support increasing the Portland Police Bureau staffing? Well, here it goes, folks. Absolutely not. I am diametrically opposed to continuing to doing the same thing we've been doing for 250 years. Criminalizing and penalizing people has led us to where we are now. We all know where we are. We see where we are. We voted for real change, which is why I'm up here, why the rest of these candidates are up here. No, I don't. As far as public safety, I absolutely have an idea of how I would like to see public safety addressed. In my perfect wave a wand world, it would happen overnight, but we'd need a nice transition. And I would like you to envision everything we have now, but restructured. Let's have, and I don't like Portland Street Response name because it's been tainted and everyone talks bad about it. We'll come up with a new name. We've got some pretty good advertising businesses here in this local area. We can figure that out. But Portland Street Response 2.0, and they need to lead the way. And when I say that, instead of our police being ahead of everything and then Portland Police or Portland Street Response underneath the fire department and everything else, Portland Street Response, or our entity that is that, needs to be leading the way. And then everything else will work down through that. You'd call 911, you'd get an operator, they'd ask you what kind of emergency you needed, and they would literally send out the appropriate person. So that would be my answer for that question. Thank you, Seamus.
Hi, my name is Laura Stribe, and I am a resident of St. John's neighborhood, specifically Cathedral Park. And as far as policing goes, I would like to see it change. There has been federal requirements that the police have been trying to work through or ignoring since 2003, 2004. And we really need to follow those federal guidelines that have been handed down to make sure that we are not racially profiling, that we are not, that we're not continually marginalizing people. We need to have community engagement in the process of our police, and I fully agree with John about the Portland Street Response. A lot of the issues that we're seeing our mental health issues on the streets that definitely need a more softer hand to connect and work with these people and help our neighbors get the services they need. If we have police, I would like for them to be more community-based police, people that are walking neighborhoods and that broken windows kind of model versus the driving around or just flying down Lombard to arrest one person when we're calling for an emergency and they don't show up. So that's kind of how I would envision it. We have not defunded the police here in Portland. We have quite a large budget for Portland police, and so I would like to see how those resources are being used and how we can better and more efficiently use the resources that we have, because we do have a very large budget within the city of Portland, and I feel like we just need to take a look at where those dollars are going and making sure that we can be efficient in that.
I guess we're doing the standing up thing. You set the bar there, John. I'm Jennifer Park. I am from the Arbor Lodge neighborhood, previously Overlook, previously Irvington. They are all very close to my heart. And I agree with John on the front of that we need to restructure our public safety. And one of the beautiful things about this whole restructuring of city government is right now We have Portland Fire and Rescue and Portland Police Bureau being overseen by different people. We have these really siloed models of safety where they're not actually cooperating. So Portland Street Response is underneath the purview of Portland Fire and Rescue. Fire and Rescue is an $11 million shortfall. Portland Street Response doesn't even operate 24/7, is getting cut $3 million, and that's because of the way that those budgets are siloed. So nothing, Portland Police Bureau isn't fronting any of that money for Portland Street Response. So let's, as we sort of break down the way we've siloed how we run the city, but as we approach this whole new form of city government, let's look at public safety and say, what are the things that we are responding to? Who needs to respond to them? And I have a feeling we're gonna find that no, we actually don't need to increase our police count. But we do need to improve our police oversight. I think part of our challenge is that nobody wants to work in a broken institution, and that's really what we have with our Portland police right now. We have several different organizations, committees that are overseeing community engagement of policing, and they're already, there was just a proposal announced yesterday for the ballot where they're gonna even cut the power that they have to investigate police incidents. So we really need to rethink how we're doing public safety. It needs to be overseen completely and really administered and have sort of everyone involved come to the table and be funded and be responding to the things that actually make sense for their expertise.
I'm gonna follow the standing trend. Hi, thank you all for being here tonight. My name is Ilana Pertle-Guinney. I live in the Vernon neighborhood. You know, this is such an interesting question at a time when so many people I talk to feel like they don't get police response. And at the same time, we don't necessarily want to see more police on our streets. I think that most Portlanders would agree that we want to see the right type of public safety response, and I use public safety broadly, I'll talk about that in a moment, that we want to see that response be timely, which is a huge issue in our city right now, and that we want to make sure that that response doesn't criminalize people because of their race or income level. And I think if we start from those principles, and then we talk about our public safety system broadly with three parts, we have the police who respond to criminal concerns. We have our fire department that responds to fires, yes, and also medical calls. And then we have our community responses, Portland Street Response, CHAT, there are a number of other programs that have been piloted that are our crisis response. When somebody is in crisis and needs help in a way that isn't medical necessarily or fire related and that isn't criminal in nature. And if we look broadly at how do we create a public safety system where we get the right response in a timely fashion, in a way that doesn't criminalize poverty, that doesn't criminalize anybody who isn't white, then I think we can talk about what the right level of police staffing is. And I don't know if it would be 120. It might be far fewer than that. It might be just a little bit fewer than that, but I don't think we can have the conversation about what we need until we have that three-tiered response in a timely fashion where people in our district know that help will be there in the right way for anybody who needs it.
Good evening, I'm Debbie Kitchen, and I'm in the Sullivan's Gulch neighborhood. And I love the responses that we've had so far. I really do look at public safety in a broad view, and it includes policing. It includes policing for criminal activities, and it also includes protection against hate crimes. It includes safety on our streets for pedestrians, bicyclists, and people driving. So that some of that includes policing for unsafe driving, but some of it is also training and education for people. So I take a very broad view of public safety. I think that we have had fewer police officers than we had in our budgets because of training requirements. And, we have 140 officers citywide that are projected to retire this year. So there are always vacancies, and sometimes lately we've been having trouble filling those vacancies. But I don't think that our budgets are too low for policing. I think it is by focusing more on the full broad sense of public safety, having a Portland Street response that is viable, having all of our public safety efforts coordinated and managed by professional city management rather than siloed in the bureaus under individual commissioners. I just think that process has led to a lot of inefficiencies, uncoordinated activity, and we're wasting money. I think that it's not a matter of spending more money, but spending it more wisely.
All right, thanks everyone for coming. My name is James Armstrong. I'm from the Woodlawn neighborhood. I also own a business here in St. John's Cathedral Eye Care. I have a unique experience with the police in that mostly I see them around 2 a.m. At one of my businesses because someone's broken in. That's happened a couple dozen times in the last few years. That does not mean I'm up here saying, oh my gosh, we need more police. The frustrations we have as business owners is that all the police are doing is responding long after something's happened. I've had a lot of conversations with various people in the police department, various people that are working on these issues about preventing crime. And here in St. John's, we have a St. John's Safety and Livability Committee with the boosters where we're actively trying to do things to increase safety in our neighborhood. One thing I did personally to try and understand this issue better, because I think it's something we're gonna all be talking a lot, is I went on a police ride-along. I went on a police ride-along in East Precinct in the middle of the night, and it was not boring. There was a lot going on. But what I also learned is they're very short-staffed, and there are no other resources available in the middle of the night. There's no Portland Street response. There's no Project Respond. There's just police officers, and that's a problem because we went to a lot of calls that didn't need a gun, and we were helping people, and these police officers I worked with, they were very professional, but they didn't need to be there. And when we're talking about budget and we're talking about resources, there's a lot of opportunities for trained professionals that want to help their community to be involved with the Portland Police. Chief Day has been asked this question and he agrees with it, and I kind of agree too. I think Portland Street Response should be under the Portland Police Bureau. I think they should welcome it. I think they should bring it in. I think they should fully fund it, and they should listen to Portlanders that say, we want, next to police officers, we want someone who's unarmed that's there to help the community that's in crisis. So.
Hi, my name is Mark Kohler. I live on Hayden Island. A little different setup than a lot of the folks have. First of all, this is not a two-minute question to answer. I will try to talk a little bit about what we're doing on Hayden Island. All of us have experienced the results of policing that isn't effective. A lot of it has to do with how we hire and how we train. We really need to reinvent the police department here. My son's motorcycle was stolen twice, two different times. Both times we had it on video. The police basically said, file an insurance claim. And I think as a small business owner, I've heard it from others that that's what you do. Half of the police responses have been for drug overdoses. And as people have said, there are other alternatives than sending a policeman when someone has a drug overdose. What we're doing on Hayden Island, which is very interesting, is that we have a neighborhood association there that has gotten very active. And I think that's really the key to security and safety, is getting all of us more involved in our own neighborhoods. We have a system called, it's an interesting acronym, it's CSI, it's community, security, something or another. But it's actually, we tie into the cameras that exist in our association neighborhoods and the retailers. And through a relationship, and I can talk about it some more if people were curious to hear about it, but it allows us to be interacting with events before they happen to help prevent those kinds of things. On Hayden Island, we've lost our restaurants, our supermarket, our bank. We have nothing left there because of the retail crime situation. I think a lot of that has to do with how we we staff, and yes, exactly what everybody else said. The kind of responses that we need to do has to do with dealing with people who are going through crisis, whether it's a mental problem, which is so much of the calls for people who are in crisis. So anyway, I'd like to talk to people about what we're doing on Hayden Island and talk to the other neighborhood associations about how we can use that same kind of neighborhood involvement. The police aren't going to solve our problems. I think we know that. The police also belong to the mayor, not to us. So we don't have that kind of authority to change it. As a group, we have to agree, and I think a lot of us are agreeing with what needs to be done. And I think as a council, we will be able to provide the kind of guidance to the city council, through the city council, to the mayor, to do what we need to do. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brooklyn Sherman. I live in St. John's, right by Pier Park. You know, I live right up the street. I recognize many of your faces. And obviously, as Mark said, this is not a two-minute issue. If any of you guys want to talk to me, always talk to me. I can reach out to me via email or phone number. My phone number, I'll tell it to you all now, is 971-888-9844. And that's this phone number. So I'm very reachable. Obviously, it's off right now, but normally it's on. But yeah, so my problem is a lot of people, when they're talking about policing, we're not talking about how if we don't get more eyes on the street, people are getting forced to go to private options like security. And we need to understand that we don't get more police officers at this time on the street to be visible, to walk around and just patrol. And obviously, we need to fund other bureaus. Because again, it's about getting more eyes on the street. Because if we don't provide, as a city, eyes on the street, people will go to private alternatives. And we need to stop privatizing law enforcement. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Ruben Berlin. I'm from the Beaumont-Wilshire neighborhood. There has been a lot of good ideas already up here, and I believe they're Portland Street Response is probably one of the best things we can do, and if we can fund that into a 24-hour program and take a lot of burden off our police, so they're not just being reactionary, they're not just responding to emergencies that they don't need to be there, I would hope that the police could be more investigative in nature and work on ongoing crime or, you know, individuals that are perpetrating a lot of these break-ins and ongoing events that really bother our local businesses and homeowners. And so if we can solve a lot of those issues, that would be great. One of the issues in talking, and James, you've been able to get a ride along. I've put in two requests. I've not yet been able to get one myself, but hopefully that will come up soon. I would like to talk to the Portland Police. I've been able to talk to other districts, Happy Valley, Clackamas County, and Washington County, and they're all in competition with us here in Portland for hiring new officers. And so how do we attract more people here? One of the stats, and I don't know how accurate it currently is, that only less than 20% of the Portland police officers actually live and work here in Portland. I would like to find some incentive to get more people that want to live here, work here, and police here to be from here and know their community. And I think that could add a lot of value to our Portland Police Department along with the Portland Street Response. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Mariah Hudson. I'm from the Alameda neighborhood. I have a seventh grader. And for the money that he gets for his allowance and spends on pizza, he could buy a couple days worth of fentanyl. And I mention fentanyl, and I mention our drug problem, our hard drug problem here in Portland, because it takes up extraordinary resources with our police force. And it is not simply a downtown problem, it is an everywhere problem. It is getting in the hands of kids. It is a major concern for me as a parent, and one of the reasons I'm running for city council. And I bring this up because when Portland Street Response stepped back, when Portland Police stepped back from their narcotics unit, from fully staffing that, and from the street crimes units a couple of years ago, when we failed to fill vacant positions in Portland Police, we really lost that that ability to go after and bring to justice drug dealers. And so in terms of our right-sizing our police, I think that's how we need to think about it, is we need to think about North Precinct as, is it right-sized? I worked up in that neighborhood when I was at Portland Community College serving on the Albina Killingsworth Safe Neighborhoods Coalition. That was an effective coalition that reduced gun violence through community policing. It brought together North Precinct, it brought together the college, it brought together business owners and ministers and community members, all to prevent violence there and to reduce drug crime as well. So I think we need to right-size this. In terms of how we are funding right-sizing our police, I think we absolutely need the technology. We need the training and the resources for our police to do their jobs well and to focus on that so we can bring down response times. By dealing with drugs, we deal with the main problem that is taxing our police and our systems here. We can do that through addressing overtime and right-sizing both our police and our fire department in that response. Right now, we have $11 million that went this past year to overtime with the Portland Fire Department. What we need to do is have that appropriately staffed, because overtime is the most expensive way to deal with a problem. So I support absolutely having the right size for our police here in North Precinct so that they can reach our communities. Thank you.
Yeah, hi, my name is Chris Olson. I'm in the Sullivan's Gulch neighborhood. For my short answer is no. Police don't prevent crime. Police don't prevent crime. And I'll share a story about that real quick. So the other day I had a friend who was walking just by his house and saw a domestic dispute and ended up just seeing this guy yelling at a pregnant woman for multiple minutes, and he ended up standing there and then going ahead and recording that incident. As that incident was happening, as he was recording, the gentleman who was yelling at this pregnant woman started to approach him, started to threaten him. He ended up having to go ahead and spray pepper spray in order to defend himself, and then he was able to go back into his home. Moments later, his partner called the police, et cetera, et cetera. Moments later, he found out from the Portland police that the gentleman had schizophrenia, and he was going through a schizophrenic episode. We don't have the infrastructure in our city to handle these types of situations. And that a friend of mine was scared to call the police if this situation was handled wrong by them. He didn't want that to happen. And knowing that we don't have the resources to handle any type of nonviolent situation, he didn't feel like comfortable calling them. So, and short answer is this: if you go to the PSR study PSU put out, 97% of PSR calls could have been handled, or were originally supposed to be handled by the police. And 68% of those calls were mental health calls, and 60% of those were homeless people. So we have a real issue in response to actually our mental health and our homelessness crisis. This is what's making our community safe, and an armed response is not the response for that. Thank you.
As the caboose, I could just say ditto and be done with it. My name is Jonathan Tassini. I'm a proud member of the UAW, a proud union member. And I live in Elliott. There's a bunch of material that I left on the desk. If you read it and have questions, you can email me. Before I answer this question, I want to take 20 seconds to, because it's on my mind, it may be the only chance, to just note what's happening in Gaza, because I want people not to turn away from that. Our tax dollars are being used to kill children. And so I would like people to think about that, to go home and do something about that, even a small thing. We're lucky to actually live in a state where our representatives, particularly Jeff Merkley, has been very much out front calling for an immediate ceasefire. Now, on the policing question, so to me, the first question is, what are police for? And I think you were quite right to ask that question. And I think that's really before us as a new city council. And I tie that to the attempted rollback of Measure 110, which I oppose. And I think, and I oppose that because it's a response, in a certain way, a human response, to things that we see. We see a crisis. we see something happening in the streets. It's the same thing with homelessness. It's the same thing with people not being able to afford their gas and their groceries. And as a union member, I draw all this back to the question of whether we need policing, how we deal with our infrastructure in the city, to the question, the very fundamental question is, people do not have enough money in the city. People do not earn enough money in their paychecks. And because people are, frankly, always desperate, do not earn enough money, that's where you see people sometimes turn to crime out of desperation. That's the kind of question I think we have to raise at the city council. And so the question of staffing of the police, I don't know whether it should be 3 or 500. I think the fundamental question we have to ask is, what is happening in our city that is causing the things that we find quite oppressive?
Thank you.
All right, thank you all. So we're at the half an hour mark. So if you are able to come up with a question for the candidates, Ruth is walking around now with a basket to collect your questions. And then not this round, but the round after will be the start of audience questions. Okay, so our next question is, in this new form of government, there will be 4 districts, 3 representatives from each district. 12 councilors is a lot of people. So how do you build consensus and how do you get things done when you have that many people on a city council? So we're gonna start here.
Thank you. So my background is in advocacy and policy development. I have literally spent most of my career trying to figure out how on an issue you get the right people in a room, get all of the ideas out on the table, figure out which of those are actually good policy that can work to move forward, and then make some hard decisions about which one we're going to run with. Building consensus in a group of 12 actually sounds great to me. That's much smaller than what I'm used to working with. But in all seriousness, when you're dealing with a council, when you're dealing with what is essentially a legislative body at the city, those 12 people have to have relationships. They have to understand that the person you're working with one day might be somebody who you're not working with the next day and vice versa, and those relationships have to be deeper than any particular issue. That means we have to operate with respect. It means that we have to operate in listening to each other. And I think we can all prove our ability to do that or not, but hopefully to do that in the way that we listen to you all through the campaign, because we need to build consensus not just with 12 people, but with a city full of people who have very different perspectives on things. I think that, as I think back on my career and the things that I've done, one of the things that I have been known for among my colleagues is that type of listening. I have reached out to people who I know I will disagree with on an issue to say, look, I think that I have the votes on this issue. I think that I am going to win on this issue. You think you have the votes and you're going to win. Okay. But either way, this needs to be good policy. So let's sit down and figure out what the best possible policy should be. And then we can find out whether or not it passes. That's the type of approach I would bring to working with my colleagues. I would also bring that type of listening, putting all the issues on the table, and then not being afraid of making hard decisions about how we move forward as I work with all of you as your counselor.
Well, I also am excited about having 12 people on council. I think the fact that we will have districts for the first time will really change how this city is represented. The fact that we are electing 3 from each district allows there to be different voices, even from within districts, that can bring ideas together. I have worked in my careers and my volunteer activities a number of times with groups that are of 12 to 16 in size, and it's often a process of working together, and again, listening, sharing our ideas, and coming together. But I think, I was on the Charter Commission, and we studied a number of city governments in the process, and one of the things that we learned in cities where they have multi-member districts like we're going to have is they often, when the councils were larger, they would often have committees to do some of the work. And you need to balance the committees and make sure that, say you have a committee on public safety, you would have at least one person from each district. So you make sure that all the districts are represented. But within the three representatives of each district, they might each participate on a different committee so that your district is represented as well as being able to cover a number of areas. So I think committees are something that was anticipated in the charter reform, and that would be one way to have a group that works more closely with a topic. And then the other part of it is just that when you have three members representing and then 12 as a city, you really do have the opportunity to bring different voices to the table and really represent the communities that we have within our city. So I think it will be much richer and a very strong way to go into decision making and implementing our city's plans.
So you were on the Charter Commission? All right, I'm sorry. I have to admit, when it first got announced, I wasn't a fan of the multi-member district. I was districting, 100%. Multi-member district, ranked choice voting, whew, that sounded like a lot. But I'm getting optimistic about it, and here's why. Representation matters. I'm running for office because I'm a small business owner, a forensic accountant, works on complex financial issues. My dad got a kid at Portland Public School, also a white male. My perspective has been present in many forms of government when it comes to the white male in me. What we're gonna have in the multi-member district is we're gonna have the opportunity to have a lot more different perspectives, and I'm excited for that, and I'm excited to work with that. So I've come around, I'm excited. Just looking at the candidates, I'm really excited with the diversity we're seeing in backgrounds and opinions and everything. So very excited for that. My background, it's hard to pick one thing to talk about how I work well with people, but if I was gonna have to go with something, I would point out the fact that I've been in business for over 10 years with my wife. And if any of you know my wife, she's lovely. She might be some of your eye doctor. She is a type A personality. She will see something and get it done. Me, the big picture, the calming influence, the how do we get what you want to happen, how do we make it happen. Rebecca, you're here. We work well together, right? Okay. So that's how I feel. I'm really excited. Everyone I've met so far in this process has been fantastic. I think, at some point we'll start to see some opinions start to come out, and hopefully we will get nowhere near what we see with the county and the city relationship. I think we can all shoot for that as a model of what not to follow. But I'm optimistic about this, and I'm really excited for it. So.
Yes, we are all facing an interesting challenge here of trying to work potentially with 12 other or 11 other people from various districts. We all have, we are here as elected to be representing our particular district first and foremost, and they're not all the same. Hayden Island, we are right on the cusp of the I-5 bridge. So that neighborhood is really concerned about what's the effect of that. Some of the other neighborhoods are not quite as concerned about that. So we all have varying priorities in terms of how we truly represent our district. And I think one of the biggest challenges, of course, is how do we work together? Some of us, I hope at least three of the people up here will be part of that new city council. How do we get together and understand how to work together? I think it's wonderful what you said about how we gain consensus. My career was in organizational development. I spent years as a training director working with leadership training, team building, and that kind of stuff. And that's part of why I wanted to get involved when I heard about this situation is we can't have 12 people fighting against each other about these different priorities and never get anything done. So that's really what I bring, I think, to the table is, I used an expression the other day that somebody got angry at me for saying, but I said I wanted to be the adult in the room, and some people saw that as I was critical of young people, but no. I think we need to have some people who can work in the city council to really get everybody to work together, because clearly we don't know who those 12 people are gonna be, and we're gonna probably have another 20 to 40 people in this race before it's over anyway. So I've been trying to get to know as many people as I can on a personal level. Hopefully I'll have the opportunity to work with some of the people up here. And I've also been meeting people in the other districts as well, trying to build consensus amongst other people about what is that common platform going to be. Because that's all we really do, you know, as a city council. It's going to be setting priorities, but we don't have the authority. So we have to be really in line with each other about what we want our city managers and our mayor to really do to help our neighborhoods and our city. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I forgot to mention earlier, I liked what you did, the walking around, mentioned you're a union member. Go unions. I'm in ATU 757 myself. And yeah, about this is, under the new system, if you don't have six other people in city council who agree with you on an issue, you're just a professional complainer. That's all you're going to be. And so we really have to work together well. And we're also going to have less staff than the current system. Under the current system, they got a little team going. Each one got their office, their little team with them. We're going to have one staffer, each one of us, whoever gets in. So it's going to be very important that we work well together and communitively. Also, we got to just communicate better overall. And I have mixed feelings about this new system of government. I think there's a list of problems with it. I'm sorry, Kitchen. Just going to be honest, I think there's a list of problems. And I think a lot of these problems are going to come through, and we're going to be complaining about them for quite a while. But with this change, we have now established that we're willing to have change. And that's what I'm happy about. Because the old system, it worked 107 years ago, doesn't work now. And we, by establishing that we're willing to change our governmental system, we will be able to move towards even a better governmental system in the future, I hope. Thank you.
So it's still real early, actually, in all this process. A lot of us are just starting to get to know each other. Some of us sat down and had some conversations with people in other districts and just find out what their priorities are. I think that needs to continue. When city council comes in, there's going to be a very short amount of time to make sure that set priorities go through, and then you're going to start to see slates, and some people will get elected, some people won't, but they'll all be come together and say this list of priorities is what we're going to need to do. My effort would be on accountability, most of all, and clarity on how the decisions are being made, and that why decisions are being head forward. I think the current process right now is that a lot of the time the buck gets passed down and no one takes responsibility for it. In the end, this is a decision that we're making, and this is going to be why, and we're going to stick through it to the end. We've seen that process. You know, if it's not effective pretty quickly, it gets taken away, and I would really hate to see this opportunity of districts and good people up here participating in the system to be taken away so quickly or go down a path that people aren't listened to. So thank you so much.
Hi, Mariah Hudson again. Let's talk about why we're here at this moment, having this election and electing 12 council members. It's because the old system, run by five people who didn't necessarily live in the areas that they served at large, did not work. The communities didn't feel that they had someone who was listening to them and in their community. As chair of the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, I've heard a lot from my communities, not just neighborhoods, but all sorts of communities and the nonprofits that we seeded through the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods. And we've done some things. It's required a lot of collaboration, a lot of people at the table to accomplish things like siting what was initially a really unpopular low-barrier homeless shelter at the corner of MLK and Killingsworth. That became a successful project through engagement with our neighborhoods. And I raise this because it's so important that our council members are really connected in with the district. That is, to me, a really essential part of the job and will require collaboration between the three people in the district as well as with the entire council. I also have a background as a legislative advocate. I worked on women and children's legislation, things around childhood nutrition, foster care, and so forth. So I know what it takes to bring the three Republicans we needed to the table to get things passed. And it's finding something that works for everyone. Some piece of it that people can understand and have a part of, and see how that's going to work and benefit in their communities. And I think that'll be the same, as we need 7 votes on our council to address our really pressing problems around homelessness, around drug addiction, and around affordability here in Portland. I look forward to working across the council in a system that I understand is legislative, but also being very connected and listening into our communities to make sure that those solutions that we're passing don't just fit in Southeast, don't just fit on the West Side, but also fit here in North Portland.
Hey everyone, again, this is Chris Olson. As I think about collaboration and a consensus among our 12 city councilors, I think about values. I think that values is what unites people. I think what I'm trying to do and what we could see here in our city is having a city council for the first time in a long time that reflects the values of Portland, that reflects compassion and empathy and collaboration and honest like representation of the people in their districts. That's what I want us, I bring to the table. I bring my values that I hopefully share with all of you. And then on top of that, ranked choice voting, if I can pivot in a second. And first of all, Debbie, great job on the charter reform. I really love it. So I just want to give a shout out there. Ranked choice voting is going to change the game here. It's going to be wild. Like let's be real. You're going to have to actually be able to vote your values for the first time. You're not going to have to vote for someone you feel is like the lesser of two evils. And that's going to be a wild change in our city government. So you'll have the option to pick 6 people who you think reflect your values. And I do trust that you out there, Portlanders, will pick 6 really good people, and then 3 of them will end up winning in this district that will reflect these values of empathy and compassion and understanding and building a stronger community from the ground up.
So since walking was a thing, I have to keep doing that. So are you the one that we have to complain about all the charter commission problems? All right, so Debbie's the one that we get to complain to. She's the receptacle for all that. And by the way, when you talked, I did feel calm when you were saying your calming voice. So let me make 3 points about this. And it's about bipartisanship, solidarity, and drawing the line. Raise your hand if you've heard of the concept of bipartisanship, right? We've all heard about that. It's a bunch of bullshit, and I'll tell you why. What we think of as bipartisanship is, oh, why can't people get along? Why are they yelling at each other? And in fact, in Washington or throughout any city, there's bipartisanship every single day. Both sides agree, tax cuts for the rich. Both sides agree, we should keep the minimum wage at a poverty level. There is complete bipartisanship about the things that are hurting every single one of you. Solidarity. That's why I'm so proud to have been endorsed already by 7 unions. My entire campaign is about building solidarity. Now, solidarity is not just some fancy little concept. It actually is hard to get to. I ran a union for 13 years. I can tell you, in running the union and building coalitions across all sorts of types of folks, in the feminist movement, LGBT, it's hard. There are intense arguments and fights. But, and I think Chris touched on this, the most important thing is that we have a shared sense of values and we raise the entire city's expectations about what every single person deserves. And I have 30 seconds to go. So on that, I'm gonna go to drawing the line. Yes, I will work with the entire city council, but it's not just about the city council, it's about you. And if it means drawing the line and stopping, for example, this idiotic immediate tax breaks for small businesses, before we ask, how does this affect workers, I will draw the line. I would be very vigorous at stopping that kind of policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
takes a long time for the mic to get down here, so I'm going to restate the question. So three reps from four districts, that's 12 councilors. So how do you build consensus and how do you get things done with that many folks?
Thank you. I appreciate that, rereading the question. I think we got a little off track. Appreciate it. It's all good things said. Let's just be frank. You can't be a jerk. And that's, we're in a church, so I'm not going to use the language we normally use. One of my very first jobs, well, I've had many, but I was a traveling salesman selling doors and windows in homes in Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon. Mind you, I was a young black kid from Portland. I'd never seen anything on the other side of Mount Hood. I sat in homes every single day, got called the nicest colored person they'd ever met. I was the only one they'd ever met. And let me tell you, in 1994, I was bringing in about $5,000 or $6,000 a month selling doors and windows. So I know how to get along with people. It's about compassion. It's about understanding. It's about having emotional generosity. I like what Chris talked about. I've met with the majority of the people here on this dais already, and five or six from the other districts. And I can tell you right now, there is a consensus among most of us that are up here doing this that we want to see real, actual change, and we will do what it takes to get it done. And we are not interested in fighting. The only people I will badmouth are politicians in office now. But these fine folks up here, you will never hear me say a bad thing about them because our hearts are in the right place. We will get along. It's not that hard. It's simply listening. We'll listen to you. We'll listen to each other. We are all smart enough, unlike some members of our government, doesn't think they are smart enough people to run the city. We are all smart enough to represent you and run this city.
Thank you. I'm Laura Stribe again. Over my career of starting a nonprofit from scratch and investing in our communities in North Portland and Southeast, the only way that we've been able to be a nonprofit for the last 17 years is to connect with neighborhoods, connect with educators, connect with artists, connect with families. I am really good at talking to people. You should ask my children because they're always like, oh, mom, you're talking to someone again. Can't we just go? But that is what I do. I connect with people. I like to think that my kid who says that his superpower is making friends, he got it from me. I'm really good at connecting with people, and everyone on the stage is here because we care so much about Portland. Everyone in all the four districts really want this change to happen. And so the three of us that will get elected, the three from each of the other districts, we all have a common goal and a common vision. And I feel that when we have, I think one of the first things that this new city council needs to do is to come up with a vision and a strong vision for Portland, because if you look, try and find on the Portland City website, what is their vision, what is their mission and goals? It varies from department to department, and I feel like that is kind of why we're here in this new charter review, charter system. We need a common vision, and so we need 12 of us to come up with that great plan so that we have a path to move forward and work together so that we can be a better Portland for all of you.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Park again. Thank you for repeating the question, because what I had remembered hearing was, how am I going to get 11 people to admit that I'm married all the time? But it's actually, how are we going to get consensus? So I think one thing I want to point out is many of the themes of things we're talking about across the city, homelessness, drug crisis, public safety, these are things everyone's talking about. So it's not, we all agree that that needs to be addressed. So it comes down to how do we address it? And we're gonna need to sit down and have conversations and all come with our ideas and debate them and come up with the best policies. And part of that is gonna be community engagement and saying, hey, this is the policies we're thinking about. These are the approaches that we're thinking about. District 2, what do you think? Are we representing you properly? Is this what you wanna see? And then the second part is we get to represent districts. We get to represent North and Northeast Portland, and priorities that come out of our district may not align with the other districts. And so we're gonna have to show up and come to bat for our district and also respect that other council members are coming to bat for their districts and figure out how we collaborate where each of our districts are getting our unique needs met. Because that's a big hole that we have had in the current model. So many of the people I've been talking to while I've been out meeting folks is, here's what we want to see in our district. Well, how am I going to get a representative from District 4, 3, or 1 to agree with adding more street trees or safer active transit routes in District 2? Because I'm gonna agree with things that they want for their district as well. So it's a sort of all of the things. We're gonna work together, but the bottom line is we're gonna show up for what you guys tell us to show up for.
All right, thank you all for that thoughtful response. Now we're on to your questions. These are the audience questions. So the staff of the North Peninsula Review has chosen three questions. I'm not sure if we'll get to all three. We'll see how the timing goes. For each one of these rounds, you'll each have 2 minutes to respond to the question. And the first question is another two-parter. So here we are at St. John's Church, and across the street is the St. John's Village, which is a transitional housing development. So this question is, what are your policy plans for guiding the life cycle of temporary housing solutions for unhoused? And then the second part, and I can repeat this maybe, is do you have a long-term strategy for getting people into permanent housing? So how do you guide temporary transitional housing, and then what's your plan for long-term permanent housing? We're gonna start with you, Brooklyn.
Why, thank you. Yeah, I care a lot about housing. Today, before coming here, I just drove back from Salem, where I was on the floor, you know, trying to talk to senators and House and legislators about how much Bill 1530 is important to us. It helps with rent control. You guys can read it. I know the bills are silly numbers, but we for the long term, I want to tackle that first since I care so much about it. Currently, we only have rent control laws really for, you know, the rent cap only starts if the place is 15 years or older, the house. And it's only 10% per year. Do you get a 10% wage increase every year? I don't. I don't think anyone in this room does. And if so, tell me what job you have. I want it. So we need to first make sure that we work on renters' rights, make sure that we don't have tax hikes, you know, on our property value so we can actually continue to be members of this community. And for the temporary housing, it is annoying how the current city council seems to kind of be relocating things to our neighborhood and having foreign interest groups from California and other places run a lot of this stuff from afar. And we need to address having this stuff run locally and making sure that it's more evenly distributed. Because the current city council, you'll never hear them be like, man, we should build a Safe Rest Village in the Southwest Hills. Let's build one in like the bougie part of town. You'll never hear that. And we need to make sure the new city council addresses the housing crisis, but not in a way where it's pinning the unhoused and the working class, like we are in this neighborhood, against each other. Thank you, my time's almost up.
So I wanna say yes, that local control is one of the most things that we can't abdicate. I don't think there is a plan what happens if that California company just were to disappear on us, and what would happen to these rest villages? How? What's the emergency plan to take those back over? So when we talk about temporary housing, I would worry that those separate safe rest villages become an institution in themselves and aren't really temporary but ongoing forever the plan. When we talk about actual permanent housing, instead of talking about median income and market rate and all those sort of things, we need to talk about the base rate as far as SSI, SSA. You know, how do we keep people in their homes long-term? How do we make sure that those apartments that are going to be long-term affordability? We have PGE coming up with a 70% increase. All these stressors are coming. So the unfortunately, I think the recession isn't already upon us, and we just haven't felt it yet. Every day we hear about layoffs, and when that happens to you, it is an immediate depression. You know, and it's not a recession, it is, and it's going to be hard to find and replace those jobs. We need to talk about building units where you can permanently affordable for people, that it can be an ongoing managed thing. And yeah, I appreciate it.
We know that the number one cause of homelessness is people losing their housing because it is unaffordable or they have come into a life crisis that has pushed them out. The best way to address our homeless crisis, in addition to addressing addiction, is to address more housing. We are at an incredible point here in Portland where we have underinvested for years. You know, things were going well. It felt good here in Portland. The market was booming, and we underbuilt our housing. But we have an opportunity right now, right here in District 2. I'm excited to be in this district because we have three major housing projects that are going to come online in the next few years. And what we do with those housing projects, and I'm talking about Lloyd, I'm talking about Legacy Emmanuel, and I'm talking about Albina Vision. All three of those are an incredible opportunity to build not just market rate, but also affordable and perhaps subsidized housing for folks. By building more housing, that is the way that we're going to long-term address the structural deficit in the number of homes needed. We need about 6,000 per year for the next 20 years, is my understanding, to address the current need and the projected need. Now, in terms of what we're doing for sheltering people, we need to get people indoors. To the extent that we can, we need safe rest villages, we need church basements that are opened up for temporary shelters, we need all the options on the table as soon as we can right now. And we do need to life cycle some of those out. The piece of life cycle is getting people into long-term housing, addressing their comprehensive needs, and that can be addiction and recovery as well. And mental health services. We're going to need to coordinate big time with the county on this to make this happen. But I think looking at those long-term opportunities and investing in those now is where we're really going to have an impact as a city council to structure the future here in Portland. Thank you.
Hello, Chris again. This has been on my mind a lot recently. A few weeks ago, I discovered that this past year, we've spent over $22 million on sweeps. $22 million to keep people on the streets. They get their stuff taken. It gets put into a storage unit. Usually, that stuff is then claimed by other houseless people, and then basically getting their stuff stolen. And then they have to start a cycle all over again of trying to build their you know, shelter from the bottom up. And that is insane that we're going to spend that much money to keep people on the streets and then they end up dying like Dino did, if you're familiar with that, just 2 weeks ago. So that the sweeps need to stop, and we need to use that money to actually help people and put them in housing. Next thing is that I would like to see, and when it comes to prevention of homelessness, is a renter bill of rights established in Portland. Tacoma just passed one, and there are many, many features of that that I would like to duplicate here. Like if you increase rent over 5%, relocation assistance would be required from the landlord, and that goes up with each percentage. Because much like Brooklyn mentioned, we don't get raises of 10% or 20%, and some people I've known had their rent raised 50%. So this has to stop. It's getting astronomical, and we need to have better boundaries. Next thing is that we do need to build more affordable housing. Jonathan, I know you got leaf blowers on your your website, but I don't think that's an important issue right now that our city council has to deal with. I agree with the premise of it, don't get me wrong, but we have a lot more issues, and we need to be spending our time and our money focused on building more affordable housing for the people in all of our districts throughout the city. Thank you.
So as a member of my neighborhood emergency team, I've been part of many deployments for houseless people, both in the brutal heat of the summer and in the frigid temperatures of the winter. And I've seen that firsthand. I think one of the things we have to remind ourselves is that the crisis of homelessness isn't new. In like 2 or 3 years old, this has been going on for decades, and it has to do with the lack of rent control. But it comes back, we can build all the nice affordable buildings we want. If we don't raise people's wages, they will not be able to afford the rent. That's basic math. And so one of the things that I'm proposing, I'll say this, the Portland Metro minimum wage is $15.45 an hour. You can do the math. That's a poverty level wage for a family of four, as the federal government thinks of it. So even when people are working at what we think is a high minimum wage compared to the outrageous and immoral federal minimum wage, that is not enough to pay the rent. So I'm proposing a significant minimum wage raise, which obviously is a state issue, and we'll have to really fight for that, and generally to raise people's wages. And the second point is, in addition to my leaf blower proposal, there is above that a whole section about affordable housing, which you can read on my website. That's outside on the table. And I'm working on a project with a developer, union pension funds, an architect, and I know where we're going to put it. This sounds like the secret plan to end the war, right? I hope the numbers come together, but I am very mindful of trying to build affordable housing, but that has to be paired with raising people's wages so they can pay the rent. Thank you very much.
Nice. Okay, thanks. Again, it's a long way over here, so I'll repeat this two-part question. What are your policy plans for guiding the life cycle of temporary housing? And then, do you have a long-term strategy for getting people into permanent housing?
Thank you. I'm going to be brutally honest with you. I'm not a politician. I did, back in the day, do a little stand-up comedy. Unfortunately, this isn't a joking matter. I don't have a policy because I kind of wholeheartedly disagree with the task sites and all that stuff in general. I think it's inhumane to pick people up where they're from, where they've formed a bit of community. Just because someone is a drug addict, just because someone is living on the street, they are a human being, okay? I know it's an eyesore. Okay, and it used to anger me back in the day, but it makes me want to cry sometimes. The conditions that I see in the United States of America, in Portland, Oregon, where I live, I don't care about a policy about temporary shelters. I don't think they should be a thing. Do I have a long-term plan? Yes. Do I have a vision? Yes. And it stems from compassion and humanity. And it doesn't mean that somebody else is getting rich. And I'm sorry, but it comes down to economics, and someone's making money off these task sites. Someone's making money buying tents, giving them to people, like Chris said, sweeping them, wasting $22 million of our hard-earned tax money to keep people on the street. It's inhumane and it's cruel. Meet them where they're at. Use the resources we have in this city. I have spoken to several nonprofits who are begging for the money, who have proven track records that can give us financial statements. And our city council and our county commissioners ignore them, don't give an opportunity. We have everything we need here to solve this problem in a humane and compassionate way, so I'm sorry for not answering directly your question, whoever asked it.
Hi, Laura again. Living in St. John's and watching the Safe Rest Village go in, I'm sure you all, if you live here, know that it was a lot of community discussion, a lot of heated arguments, and it is here, and the individuals that have been living in these spaces have a safe place to be. They are now finishing school. They are looking for jobs. They are getting jobs, and they are investing in their own lives to be able to move out of those spaces into more permanent housing. And those kinds of Safe Rest Villages are happening all around our city. They have a place to be. They do not have to worry about their stuff. They don't have to worry about their safety. They have wraparound supports. And so if we can replicate that as a temporary solution so that they can get their feet back under them in a humane way, then they are able to finish some schooling, finish a trade, get a job, feel secure in that, and move on from that space. Another thing we need to do is kind of back up the river and look at our permitting system. The BDS just laid off 72 people in December. How are we going to get permits to build all these houses that we are supposed to require for the 6,000 people that we need to build houses for in our community, when permitting takes 100 to 400 days? We don't have investments that can wait that long. We don't have people that can wait 400 days before something can get built. We need to bring those people back into their jobs so that we can get permitting going, so that we can then work with our community partners. Like, it's really encouraging to see Vision One, Albina One, and the Albina Vision Trust have these great visions for our community in building housing and thinking about that. We need more community partners like that, and I feel like that's what we need to do as a city, is look at our community partners.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Park again. I spent 6 years working in supportive housing in San Francisco before I came to Portland 10 years ago. Part of that was as the general manager of a 94-unit supportive housing hotel. I have a lot of thoughts about housing, and I will not be able to convey them all to you in the next 2 minutes. But first, to answer the question, supportive housing, or the temporary housing life cycle, we need a housing-first harm reduction model where people are not restricted in order to get into a house. If you want to get clean and sober, if you need to get healthy, you need to have housing in order to do that. You need wraparound services. So I fully 100% believe we need harm reduction models, and then once folks are in housing, they need all of the supports. We see people aging out of temporary housing and going back to the street because they didn't get the supports they need to be successful. Why put people in buildings if we're not going to help them be successful in those homes? Many people who signed leases in our supportive housing hotels had never signed a lease before. In addition, we need more permanent housing. I have a lot of ideas on how we can do that. Just last night, I posted on my website and sent out to my newsletter a housing study I did on commercial conversions, which is something that we have the opportunity to do here in Oregon, thanks to last year's legislative session, opening up these models. So check out my website and find out about that. I also have harm reduction housing policy models coming out. If you have questions about housing, I would love to talk to you about them. But bottom line is people need full supports to be successful, and we need to change our expectations.
So I want to start with two things. First is housing affordability is a wage issue. I knew, Mr. Ticini, that you were going to say this before me when I saw you were ahead of me on this question. Housing affordability is a wage issue. We have to address wages as we address housing. Not instead of, but as we address housing. Two, people need stability. Whatever our solution is to homelessness, and there are many solutions, and frankly, right now, I think our problem is bad enough that we need to be doing all of them. People need stability. You need a place where you know you can sleep at night, where you can keep your things, where you know you can get a meal, if we want you to be able to do anything else to stabilize your life, get an education, get a job, find those other two meals, people need stability. So what do I think about the life cycle of our temporary housing that we have right now? First of all, homelessness is not a right now issue. It's an always issue. And we need to address homelessness right now and have a far smaller homeless population, but I am not going to stand up here and suggest that we are ever going to get to zero. Much of our current temporary housing is on plots of land that had actually been identified for long-term affordable housing. So we need to address our current locations so that we can free back up that land for our long-term needs for affordable housing. But as we do that, we are going to need to figure out what our long-term solution is for temporary housing, because that problem will not go away, that need will not go away. In terms of a long-term plan, I was talking to an affordable housing developer recently who was saying that what we think of as traditional affordable housing, that 60% of average median income, the people in that housing right now are working people, because housing is a wage issue. I'm getting the stop sign, so I will just say 30% median income housing is all needing supports right now. There is so much we have to do to invest in those types of housing, and I'd love to talk more about this later.
Debbie Kitchen, and I will agree with what other people have said, that wage issues are a huge part of our problem. I have been involved with economic development efforts throughout the metro area, and in my first career, I was a regional economist. And I will say that there are industries that we can support that provide better wages. And we need to have workforce development to help people earn those better wages, develop the skills. There, some of them are in manufacturing, some of them are in tech, some of them are in healthcare. There are a lot of areas where we can improve our wage profile for our population and help everybody be able to afford housing. But the second part of it is having an adequate housing supply. We have, as has been mentioned, we've been underbuilding for decades. And we need to both lower the cost of housing. Part of that will be through permitting and streamlining our coordinating our bureaus. We have 8 bureaus they have to go to for housing, and they don't work together or aren't coordinated. I think with the new form of government, eventually we'll see some results there that will lower our cost of housing. We need to focus on prevention, and in prevention, it's that is the best dollar we can spend, is keeping people from becoming homeless. We've increased the number of shelters. We've built affordable housing, and we're not keeping up because more people are falling through the cracks and are becoming homeless. They're becoming homeless faster than we can house people. So prevention, that's where I would focus a lot of efforts. Workforce development and skilling up our population, building more adequate housing, and then just having that continuum of supportive housing services to help people move from homelessness into long-term stable housing.
All right, this is a really big issue, and I'm not quite sure where to begin, but I do want to start with something a little different, and that's speaking specifically about some stuff that's happening in North Portland related to some of the task sites that are being proposed, the day center that's proposed downtown, and even the bottle drop facility. I'm going to get to the bottle drop facility because it's the audience. So as a member of the St. John's Boosters Safety and Livability Committee, I've been on a lot of communication with the city when it comes to how they present these new ideas to the community. A lot of times what they do, they send an email, they say, guess what? We're doing this. How do you feel about it? And then we scramble together, have a meeting, and say, we're not sure, because you just told us about it. That kind of communication is kind of classic City of Portland, how they like to present things to St. John's across the rest of the city. And it doesn't work, because it makes the community feel anxious about what's happening. You're scrambling to get questions answered, and really you don't know what's going on. So I've been endorsed by affordable housing developers, by the leader of the Welcoming Neighbors Network, and by Supportive Service Housing CEO, who does a lot of work in North Portland that is very involved maybe with something right across the street. That's because of the conversations that I've had with them and the experience that we've had working through some of the issues that matter to the community. These things are necessary. The task sites are successful in moving people through the system. The people that work there are extremely engaged in providing a caring, human-focused approach to getting people housed. They're not the answer, though. They are far more expensive than the real long-term solution. It is should not, 5 years from now, we should not be expecting your community to just have to house people in small sheds. We should build towards a full, sustainable system for supportive services. And that was really quick, but you have been doing an amazing job tonight.
I just wish I had an hour to talk about this piece, but I'm going to try to cover three or four things very quickly. First of all, I think I'm the only one here on the panel who's living on a fixed income. I know a lot of you, I see folks whose hair is sort of the same color as mine, who are forced to deal with the fact that our income is not going to go up anywhere near this 10% baloney that they talk about as an annual increase as okay. No, I have a plan actually that I would present that if you are living on a fixed income, whether it's from Social Security or disability or other sorts of veterans benefits and things like that, that we can restrict the increases in your rent to the cost of living adjustments we get on our Medicare or Social Security. So I think that's one way. We have to protect the people who are housed now from becoming homeless. That's one big piece, and there's a lot of stuff about that. Another piece about the homelessness thing, let's think about it. You know who's doing all the good stuff? It's not the government. It's the faith-based organizations. It's the nonprofits, and it's the philanthropists. We are in a house of worship now. Did you think the city was going to give us this opportunity and pay for this opportunity for us to talk to all of you? Who's doing it? That's where the good work is doing. There's also a group called Hope for the Homeless that I work with. What they do is they also evaluate the effectiveness of where are all these millions of dollars that are going towards homeless services? How many of them are truly effective, and what are they really accomplishing? And this organization just made a $300,000 grant to a group called City Team. I don't know if you know that group downtown. Not in my district, but they've got 35 people that are housed now that weren't before. The last thing I want to talk about, and I'll do it as quickly as I can, the $650 million housing bond that you all voted for, not a single unit was ever affordability. It didn't take a single person off the street. All of those, all that money went to developers. It went to the big banks. So one of the things on my site that I talk about is the creation of a municipal bank. So those resources that we're spending towards housing goes to us, not to big developers and not to big banks. That's a whole nother issue. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, I know that 2 minutes goes by so fast. We have time for one last question, and we'll get you out of here by 8:30. This one is, I am concerned about the toxicity of the area due to the CEI hub, tank farms, and a Superfund river site. So, as a city councilor, how will you address our safety and mitigate toxicity, especially with the danger of earthquakes? And I'm going to do something crazy. We're going to start down at Jonathan and work our way to John.
Jonathan's John. I'll answer that quick snippet. One of the things I will remind every business person and person that comes before the council is that the greatest economic development strategy, bar none, is unionization. And it's the old Henry Ford maxim. He was a really bad person, but he thought, I want to make sure, right, you're nodding your head, I want to make sure my people have enough money to buy my cars. And we've forgotten that. And that's why I'm going to work very hard to raise people's wages. To your question, on my website is a thing called risk bonding. And it's something that I learned from my fellow environmentalists. As a city council member, I am going to argue for every single fossil fuel company having to require to take out risk bonds, which essentially means that we don't pay for anything that happens because of them, that they pay for any spills, pollution, any impacts on the community. Second, we need no more pipelines through here, okay? And we need, it's not a fast solution, let's be honest. I would be not telling you the truth. I said, you know, I'm gonna get elected city council, we're all gonna move all those, we're gonna get out there ourselves. Debbie's gonna get the whole commission behind it, or the whole, it's not gonna happen, but we have to figure out a way, and I know this as a member of my neighborhood emergency team, I'm very aware of what lies beneath the sands there and what's in the tank. So I would commit to you to work with you and with the experts to, number one, make sure the liability is not on us, and no more pipelines through our city, and an attempt to try to figure out, and it's not going to be fast, to move that stuff out of the city.
Yeah, I mean, I don't feel like I can say anything that like Jonathan hasn't said already, but yeah, we absolutely need to, I think obviously just reinforce the infrastructure there, and then eventually as we are moving ourselves off of fossil fuels, obviously removing that and restoring the waterfront. So it's gonna be a very, very long process to do that. I'm, you know, not in support. I mean, basically everything Jonathan said, you could just repeat that. But obviously we don't, I don't want any more pipelines. I don't want to, you know, have this infrastructure continue to exist on that side of the river. It needs to be taken down. It needs to be removed eventually as we transition out of fossil fuels into, you know, more clean energy. So that's, I'm completely for that. Let's tank those tanks and start over.
Well, as a former sustainability officer and also a emergency preparedness coach, it's not a matter of if, but when we're gonna have the earthquake, and we need to be absolutely prepared for that. I think we need to start with emergency routes, ensuring that Columbia Boulevard, that people from North Portland have a way to get out, because when those tanks go, it's gonna create the kind of toxic gas that threatens our whole community. And there aren't the hospitals and resources up here in North Portland that we're all going to need. So let's talk about how we would respond to that. And it's gonna be at the neighborhood level. That's why the NET teams are so important. That's why our neighborhood associations still really have a role in our community in creating that kind of base democracy, because it's gonna be your neighbors who help you respond to these things. Now, in terms of what would I do about the fact that there are tanks right now, it's gonna be a long-term solution. It's gonna require our city putting pressure on the state, getting funding to help move those, to decommission them over time. But we need the preparedness in our communities now. I have a track record of working with the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, fighting Zenith, fighting air polluters, and bringing our communities together to do that. It's not gonna just be at the city level. We can, you know, through our permitting, we don't need to be counselors that renew permits. Thank you, let's get away from that. But it's gonna be looking for that funding that pulls things together that can make that happen. Thank you.
So with those tanks, I mean, you're gonna have to look at how to decommission them and move them and get it out of here. The bonds and the insurance and everything are great, but it really doesn't do anything for the immediate impact of an event. Being prepared to evacuate the area, having emergency kits, having emergency responses and a plan, having those be readily available as best as possible during, you know, any sort of emergency, whether that be an earthquake, fire, or any number of scenarios that can happen with those. So petitioning the state and the federal government to try and decommission them, move them, and then really have a policy where we're getting away from oil would be the best long-term policy for those tanks. So thank you.
Just gonna say it, Zenith is bad. We shouldn't have them here. And it's a chronic problem that's growing. They're getting three new pipes, you know, thanks to the current city council. And things do not look like they're on the up on this issue. And a big part of that is Zenith they're active. They pay attention to politics. If you don't think that they have someone probably paying attention to our campaigns, you're sadly mistaken. And we as a community, not just the city council, but everyone at the neighborhood association level and everywhere else in your groups, we gotta actually talk about them. And I think a chronic problem with this issue is not enough people even know what Zenith is. And we really have to discuss with our neighbors, with our friends, with the guys at the pub, or whatever you go, hey, there's this company called Zenith. They have all these tanks. You've noticed them, right? They're bad. Because when you do that, even if the people on city council aren't all like gung-ho about chasing Zenith out of town, you, by being gung-ho about it, forces them to at least acknowledge the problem, which currently isn't going on.
For those of you who looked at all of our websites, as far as I know, I may be the only one that has the induction zone on my website. But, and I really wanted to thank the people who've been passing out the material here. I think if you haven't got the material from them, and as you said to me earlier, that, you know, it hasn't always been the first thing on people's agenda, but you're going to make it on everybody's agenda. And I think that's a really key piece to this. On Hayden Island, we have one way on and off the island. It's the bridge. And I can't believe that bridge is going to be replaced in the next 5, 10, who knows how many years that's going to take. If there is a quake, we're stuck. And I know other neighborhoods, St. John's and these other neighborhoods, are all facing that same thing. What are we going to do? In this country, we are wonderful at closing the barn door after the horse has left. We can't wait for that. And as I was talking to you, I think, earlier, that, yeah, there's none of the other things we've talked about threaten our lives as much as the catastrophe that is going to come. It's just a question of when. How many of you lived here during St. Helens when it blew? You know that we're in a place that is not stable, right? And there will be a significant quake sometime in, maybe not in my lifetime, but in a lot of yours here, okay? And when it comes, it could come next week, it could come in 5 years. We got to be ready for it now and start doing things, and I really think it's wonderful that you're raising that issue. And we all need to, as council members, we need to continue to raise that issue also. It is a federal problem. We're not going to fix that. We don't have the billions it's going to take to do all that. And the companies won't do it on their own, because they're going to find all kinds of legal ways not to do that until the catastrophe strikes. So we have to organize as an organization, as a state, as a city, as a region of the United States, because this is not just a Portland issue. This is Canada all the way down to, I guess, Northern California. It's a big issue for all of us. And I think it's wonderful that you've brought it up in this question. Thank you.
James, before you start, do you want me to reread the question, or are you good?
Just yelling and making things happen. There are some amazing people in this room that have that in them, and I applaud you. I'm the inside guy. I'm the guy that is your voice working within the system that exists. Now, wow, he's saying that sounds skeptical. I've been learning a lot on this issue. One thing that I am very aware of is it's amazing how many of my kids' friends have asthma in North Portland. It is amazing how many issues there are related to air quality happening at the racetrack, happening near the railway that goes right by my son's school at Woodlawn. There are a lot of issues, and frankly, I'm learning about a lot of them just on this campaign trail. My job as a candidate is to be your voice. We are districted representation now. So what I would strive to do is be in there leveling the playing field, because as we've discussed, the powers that be, they have their own people, they have their own way of doing things. They obviously talked to city council, and Dan's not here. Maybe we could ask them what they said. Maybe they said something really great, I doubt it. But what I can promise you is that I will listen to the community and I will represent you and I will help level that playing field with my background.
As people have said here, there is a very high risk of an earthquake coming, and we do need to start getting prepared. Definitely, we need to start reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. That's something that we should be doing for multiple reasons, but also the CEI hub, those tanks, we do need to try to figure out how to move them or decommission them over time. And I think it is a federal responsibility. I think that's part of FEMA that we should be tapping into those dollars. I don't think we just have, we have a lot of dollars in the state, but not nearly enough. And I find this to be a federal issue. So I would work with, our city, our state, our county, to try to address these issues. And so reducing fossil fuel, trying to decommission those tanks or move them. I mean, we are likely to be using fossil fuels for some time in the future. So that we can reduce our dependence, but we can't eliminate it overnight. This is a long-term strategy. We need to keep working on it. And I also agree that we need to make sure that the companies provide the liability that there really is there. There are caps in some of the current laws that they're not required to cover, and this had to do with big oil spills. They weren't required to cover all of the liability. So we need to make sure that all of the liability is covered. That won't be that much comfort at the time, but it'll help. And then reduce dependence and eventually move those, and with federal assistance, I think.
I really want to thank whoever put this question in and all of the folks who have been here with information about a variety of places that meet at the nexus of environmental and safety issues tonight, because our district particularly faces more of these issues than I think any other district in the city. Not only do we have CEI Hub, not only do we have the Superfund site right along the side of the district, not only do we have liquefaction concerns just about anywhere up the peninsula from where we're sitting right now, plus anything along the northern parts of the district, the whole way along it. Not only do we have levees lining the northern part of our district, many of which are on the edge of failing. Luckily, we've got some resources coming for that from the federal government. The list goes on of places where this district in particular faces that nexus of environmental and safety issues. We need to be talking about those. They need to be a big issue in what we're talking about in this race. I want to talk specifically about CEI Hub, though. There are folks at the state and the federal government who are starting to work on that plan for decommissioning that hub. It's a long way out. But as a city councilor, I think one of the most important things we can do is make sure that our voices are active in that decommissioning plan when they start talking about where those tanks go next. Because they certainly shouldn't be on ground that's going to liquefy in an earthquake. And there certainly can be fewer of them as we move forward and decrease our dependence on fossil fuels. But we're not going to get rid of them altogether. We're not completely phasing out fossil fuels on a soon enough timeline that there won't be any tanks. So where are they going to go? Are they spread out? Are they all in one place? Are they all in District 2? I sure hope not. If I'm your city councilor, I will be standing anywhere I can to say they should not all go here. We can't be NIMBY about it, though. We can't say they should all go over there. We need to be figuring out where the least risky place is as we decommission those tanks, and I want to make sure that's part of the conversation.
So I think emergency management has been really put on the shoulders of individuals and community members, and is really, if you have the opportunity to prepare your house, to prepare your family for an emergency, that is a component that many people do not have the privilege to do. So emergency management really needs to be the responsibility of the government from the local, state, and federal level. And we're talking about the preparedness for the quake, which we all agree is inevitable at some point, and how our neighborhood is gonna be prepared for that. What's going to happen? What are the potential crises, and how do we prepare ourselves to respond to that and support the community? And then also thinking about emergency management, like on a bigger picture, right? We have more and more issues with air quality around wildfire smoke every year because our temperatures are rising because of climate. How do we address that? We need to address our heat islands in the city so that we can help reduce our climate impact locally. We need to do a lot of work around emergency preparedness, both for the quake and for all of these significant, and not only the heat, but the cold, right? But this is really, it's been far too long put on neighborhood associations, neighborhood emergency, and really community members who have the ability to invest their own time and their own money in preparing our communities. And it's really the responsibility of the city and the state and the federal government to make sure that our neighborhoods are safe in any emergency situation.
Hi, Laura again. When we did our remodeling on our house, which is just here in this neighborhood, we had to put all these tie downs and do all this earthquake preparedness so that our house is safe when the inevitable earthquake comes. So our house is going to be safe. We're going to have a structure that hopefully won't fall down in the middle of an earthquake. But those tanks, if they blow, all that gas will end our lives anyway. So in thinking about those tanks that are across the river, we need to take a look at our environmental regulations that we have in place. I'm not sure what the city has as far as a plan for that right now, but we really need to see what the city, if they've been talking to that business at all, what plans are in place, what liabilities do they have, what infrastructure are they willing to invest in right now to make it a little bit safer, even though it's on ground that will liquefy. And where is that going to go eventually? Carmen Rubio and Dan Ryan approved the Zenith pipeline coming in, which is unfortunate because they made that decision on their way out. And the current city council is, or the new city council is going to have to live with those decisions. They said it's not going to go through any neighborhoods, but any train track goes a block from my house. I know that there's never been any train derailments or pipes that have burst. That doesn't happen, does it? No, we need to be very preventative in our environmental protections and really think about our infrastructure. And as a parent, I always think worst case scenario. So I think we as a council need to think worst case scenario and plan for that with the infrastructure.
I guess I've been forgetting to say I'm John Middleton again. I'll be real frank. I think that the most important issue in all of our lives is our environment. I believe climate change is real. I think it's affected by the things we do. A lot of the things we do hurt and harm people. I don't know what to do with those tanks. I wish that I could Harry Potter them and make them all disappear. I'd like us to, for me, I would be turning to the people that are like handing out the handouts and doing this stuff because they are much smarter than I am and they will know how to handle these things. Again, and I'll go back to the second question, how are we all going to work together? I think you've heard a lot of cohesive answers all night. And I think that will go back to that first question. We can work together and get this done. D2, I'm really proud of us. We're not NIMBYs. We have three and one coming in, of the task sites. And you guys don't complain about it. You ask serious questions. Why are you going to put another one when we don't have services? We live across the river from a liquefying oil spill, and everyone keeps talking about an earthquake, and I'm scared to death of fire. It was 115 a couple years ago. I'm not a great golfer, but on a good day, I could stand at Forest Park and hit my driver into the tanks. I'm more worried about fire, so this is a pressing issue. I could promise you two things. Anything that I do in city council would be done through a lens of environmental safety and an environmental lens and how it affects us. It'll go through a racial lens, and I choose that because it's the most intersectional of all. And don't ask Zenith or nobody else. They can come. They ain't getting a permit out of me.
All right. Look at that. With 14 minutes to spare. So, first of all, I want to thank all the candidates for coming out tonight. Let's hear it. And then I'd like to thank all of you and your thoughtful questions in coming out tonight.